Someone said I hadn't told you much about diamonds, so I reviewed some of my tapes. I hadn't labeled all of them, so it made it kind of hard, but looked to me like I told you quite a bit about diamonds. What was the part I hadn't told you?
How to make them?
Well, we were almost up to that with the thermodynamics, but let me give you some more history. I don't believe I gave you some more of this kind of history. Did I tell you about the early history of diamonds, the Bible, and all that? In the book of Exodus, I've forgotten chapter and verse. I don't remember the passage identically, so I'll tell you what it's about. There is a discussion of the priestly garments to be worn by Aaron when he officiates officially in his capacity as high priest. And it went into great detail about it, and talks about, I don't even know how you pronounce the word, E-P-H-O-D, ephods. I think there are things on the shoulder, you know, like you see the soldier boys wearing sometimes that hairbrush kind of a thing out here. And well, there was a lot of that, and it described the colors and the types of cloth and things like that. And then among the items he was to wear was a breastplate made of brass. And on this breastplate there were four rows of precious stones, three stones in each row. That made 12 stones in all, each one, of course, representing one of the 12 tribes of Israel. Now, it's disappointing to me that the scriptures do not identify which stone belonged to which tribe. And I've often thought it'd be an interesting historical project to see if you could track that down. But the scriptures do not make that one-to-one correspondence. But among the precious stones that are named that fill each of those 12 places is diamond. I checked with Hugh Nibley to see if there were earlier references to diamond than that one, and he could not find any. He found fairly early references in writings, but they were derivatives of this story about Aaron and what he should wear. So, as near as Hugh Nibley knows, that is the earliest reference to diamond. Well, he hadn't even concerned himself with the problem until I took it to him, but he spent a little while searching around, and he could find nothing earlier. So that's the first reference to diamond. Now, scholars naturally disagree on who wrote the book of Exodus and when it was written. If you want to take the latest date that scholars think it was written, it would be 1100 BC. So at that time, at least by that time, man knew that diamond was a precious thing. It was classed as a gem and was valued for its beauty. Some of the other stones were things like sapphire, topaz, I think they mentioned onyx, and then there are some odd names like carbuncle. I'm not sure what that is. Nowadays it's something on the bottom of a ship that's undesirable, but in that day I don't know what it was.
What is carbuncle nowadays?
I guess I'm wrong on that. That is a barnacle, isn't it? What's a carbuncle then?
Something
on your toe, like a wart?
Yeah.
Man, I was in the Navy for 2 years, too. I think I'd remember that. Well, I think I remember which is port side. Which way is the lee? I was on leave from my ship for a week when I was anchored in San Francisco Harbor, and when I came back I seemed to be all mixed up, and the reason was I didn't know at the time they'd moved the ship. So when you come aboard ship, you come up the gangplank and you salute the officer of the deck who's there, and you salute the flag that's on the back end of the ship, and I saluted the wrong end of the ship because they turned to clear around the other side. Really had me confused. I didn't court-martial me for it. There's some other things they're tough during wartime. Boy, you sure do have to be careful. That's the part of the armed services I dislike the most. I don't think they're that tough nowadays. They could shoot you for falling asleep on the job, for instance, during World War II, which I did one time, but just woke up in time when the guard came around and he didn't know I'd been asleep. I don't know, I've probably been sleeping for an hour.
What was the job?
Guard duty. See, and to make sure everything's okay, they have circulating guards. You're on guard at some post, and then guards make their rounds all the time, you know, to make sure no one's falling asleep. The armed forces are interesting. They certainly do place a lot of responsibility on you. That's one advantage of them. You can get training and responsibility in the armed services like you could never get in a lifetime working for a company or anything like that. Of course, the bad thing about the armed services is all the, well, when you're young, it's all the sex stuff, you know, all the guys running after the girls all the time, all that kind of stuff, a lot of drinking, swearing, and that kind of thing. But it's all right. I think it's a good thing for a lot of boys. If you go on a mission, of course, and then have to go in the army to boot, it sure does seemingly take up a lot of your time. I guess that leads me to another story, so we'll never get through today. I had a very important responsibility when I was in the Navy. You weren't even born yet, I guess. This would have been back in 1946. Any of you guys born by 46? Well, you don't know it, but this whole country depended on me, at least the Western Hemisphere. During that time, your future, mine too. Well, the war was over, so it wasn't that serious. But just to show you how much responsibility they will give you, when the war was over, I had about 2 months of duty left. They had a point system for getting out during the war. And my ship was scheduled to go to the Orient. But by the time they got there and got, I don't know how long they're going to stay, I've forgotten, and got back. See, my duty time would be up. But still, they could send you. Anything that happened to you, you could go on tough if you didn't get out on your scheduled time. But my commanding officer liked me because I was one. When the war was over, you'd be surprised at how military disciplines slacked off. During the war, everything was real strict, you know, and everybody saluted and kept their shoes polished and did everything according to the book. But almost a minute the war was ended, the ship just went to pieces. It was against the rule to have women aboard ship when you're in harbor. But man, when the war was over, when you were tied up at port, women were just swarming all over the ship. And all this, I was in charge of all the radar and electronics. In fact, I was on a command ship which had all of the electronic stuff on it for the Pacific Fleet. And I was in charge of all that. I was only 25, 26 years old, and I was responsible for all this stuff. But anyway, they'd take these girls down in all the secret radar equipment and all the communications equipment and everything. Nobody paying attention. It really got kind of bad. But my nature was such, I didn't mind saluting the commander and keeping the shoes shining and acting like I was still an officer in the U.S. Navy. And he liked me on account of that. But most of the guys weren't doing it. So he says, oh, Hall, no good sending you clear to the Orient and lousing up your education and whatnot. I said, I should get back in school again. I had a master's degree at the time. I went in service in chemistry. So he got me assigned to the command headquarters at the Oakland Naval Base. That was the headquarters of the Pacific Fleet Command. Of course, that's where the big naval war was. It was out in the Pacific Ocean. So, as can happen in the Navy, you can get to be assigned a junior officer of the day. They'll say it's junior officer of the day, but the junior officer always gets that job at night, so the bigwigs can sleep. But so there's an admiral on the base who has the responsibility but really doesn't function, and at least not now that the war's over. And then another higher officer, I forget what his rank was. I think he was, I don't know what he was. Anyway, slightly down. And he was the true officer of the day for this night watch. And I got selected by however they select them to be the junior officer today. So there we are in Fleet Command Headquarters in Oakland. And comes about 10 o'clock. I think my watch is a 12-hour watch, 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. And he says, well, I'm tired. I'm going to bed. It's yours. What, me? Responsible for the whole Pacific Fleet? Yeah, tough. Your job. Here I am, 26 years old. man for one 12-hour period. I'm in charge of the Pacific Fleet, see? Well, I guess nobody cared too much because the war was over, but I already felt that responsibility. That's something, you know. Everything that's on out there, I tell them what to do. Well, furthermore, I had my instructions. He says, I'm going to bed and I don't want to hear from you unless the war breaks out again. Anything that comes up, you take care of. Those were his orders to me, see? Well, that night we had a hurricane. We had 100-foot waves on Hawaii. And I had to tell him, you know, what to do. get out of the harbor, get out to sea just as quick as you can. We have a weather report that this is coming on. I guess that's smart enough to tell them that. They'd probably been on their own anyway. But really, they are under authority, real chain of command in the armed services, that they look to you to tell them what to do. But the thing that gave me the most trouble was a bunch of drunken Marines who raided our base that night. These guys were officers. Now, if you're an officer in the armed forces at least 25 years ago, you're a gentleman by definition, at least if you're in the Navy. I'm sure we in the Navy were gentlemen. I don't know about the guys in the Army. And you had to be careful what you did to them. You just couldn't throw them in the brig or something like an ordinary guy. And you never expect things like this to happen. They're supposed to behave themselves. But there are about six of these guys got drunk on a Marine base nearby. And they were all officers. And they stole one of the Marine Jeeps. And they went out and were having a great time. So they decided to crash through our guard gate and come in on our Navy base. I don't know why, but they did it. Well, our MPs got them, and then the MPs, you know, did, what are we going to do with these stupid officers? All drunk and cutting up. And furthermore, I got a report. They said one of them is the son of the admiral on this very base. Well, I don't really got the information, but that's what they claim. Well, I didn't know what to do with them, because according to what I knew, you really couldn't throw them in the brig like you could an enlisted man do that. So finally, I had a real good idea. I decided to put them in sick bay. Sick bay is the ship's hospital, you know, that's the Navy terminology. So I had the guards tie them in bed and lay sobered up. And then we let them go the next morning and had some of the guys take the Jeep back to the Marine base where it belonged. What would I have done to it? I'd have been treated like enlisted men, but you really have those kind of problems. You're supposed to be gentlemen, and you can't do that to them. Well, we survived the night. So I just want you to know that for one night, I was in charge of the whole darn Pacific Fleet. Biggest job I ever had in my life. That kind of responsibility can hit you at a very young age, and that is a good part about military life. Golly, these young men, they'll be flying a plane worth maybe, I don't know what, $20 million, $40
million. You want $70 million.
$70 million. You're in charge. You're responsible. You've got to decide what to do with it in a situation. I guess the stuff I was responsible for, I wouldn't be surprised what the electronic gear on the AGCs, I've even forgotten what the initials stand for, AGC. We had the Admiral and everybody else on our ship. Our ship was not a fighting ship, but we had the command on it and the communications and all the anti-warfare electronic stuff. And then the battleships and the destroyers and whatnot were supposed to protect us. We were just the communications place. But I suppose that the stuff on our ship could easily have been worth, who knows, $500 million. And I was in charge of it. It's my responsibility. So like I say, that is a real advantage if kids...
And once you get out of service, do you have the responsibility, or do you just...
Well... Once out of the service, you've had, that's good training, really good training for leadership if a guy wants to be in a leadership area. But you probably never again get that much responsibility in any job you ever got. Chances are you wouldn't. Well, let's see, back to diamonds. There's another reference in the book of Exodus to diamond. And again, it has to do with the value of diamond as a gem and a thing of beauty. Then in the book of Jeremiah, there is an industrial reference to diamond. So we have both kinds of diamonds known by man. The book of Jeremiah is thought to have been written about 700 B.C. Now I call it an industrial reference. See if you see the same significance in this statement. And by the way, let me put in a plug right at this point for the King James Version of the Bible. What was happening in this part of the scriptures, as recorded in this part of the scriptures, is that the prophet Jeremiah was having a hard time getting Israel to repent of its sins. Same old story over and over again, you know. The prophet has the same trouble doing it today. Speaking of that sort of thing, did you see the little short editorial by our university president in today's newspaper?
See the last one in that series?
Well, I don't know. This is the first one I've noticed. Has there been a lot of them?
No, I mean, his was the first one, and then the last one was just the opposite one of my students.
Oh, well, was it? I didn't read that.
I'll be glad when the day comes where we don't have to be the shining light. We can...
Anyway, you see, the prophets still have a hard time with maybe what some people consider to be trivia. But heck, it's easy to do the easy things. And maybe we ought to do them because they are easy. Well, anyway, if you read something like the New Standard Version or some of these new versions which put the book in modern language, it'll shorten all this discussion up and miss the historical significance by doing it. It would say, well, Jeremiah was having a hard time with the people. They just wouldn't listen to him and do that that they were thought to supposed to be doing. And he'd go back to them and then report to the Lord and back and forth. They put it in common language and they missed the real significance. They'd miss the poetry and everything else. Now, I wish I had it to read it straight, but it says something like this. After the Lord had sent Jeremiah out maybe a dozen times to call them to repent, so they wouldn't repent, the Lord himself got kind of peeved. So he told Jeremiah to take a pen of iron, which had a point of diamond, and write their sins with that. Now how about that for some symbolism, see? You take the hardest of all known things, And use it as a scribing tool, and with that you scribe their sins. And where was he going to scribe them? They had horns on the corners of the sacrificial altars. I'm not sure exactly how that horn went. I think it was a single horn that came up sort of like that. And he used to take that iron pen that had the diamond point, and he used to write Israel's sins on the four corners of the altars where they had those horns. Well, now they changed that in a modern translation. But you see what they'd lose? They would lose the fact that man, even at that day, knew that diamond was the hardest of all substances. Isn't that what you would gather from that passage? And you'd miss all that neat symbolism and all that neat poetry. Because that says a lot. There's a lot said. Take a pen of iron with a point of diamond and write their sins away. Now, at least in the King James Version of the New Testament, diamond is never mentioned. And I checked our four standard works, and I can't find it there. So as far as I know, in the scriptures, diamond is only mentioned in three places. Twice in Exodus, and once in Jeremiah. It's thought that the diamonds that are mentioned in the Bible probably came from India. For the first written record that we have concerning diamond diggings or diamond fields where diamonds are obtained were written by a soldier of fortune from France whose name was Tavernier. He visited the Indian diamond fields, which were located on the Kishna River in the 1600s. And there he estimated that he saw about 60,000 pretty good sized city men, women, and children working the fields. The men and the boys would dig gravel from the banks of the river, put it in wicker baskets, carry it off to the side, and then the women and the kids would sort through the gravel, picking out the pebbles one at a time, searching for diamonds. And as Tavernier watched that, he estimated that they would pick out 60 million pebbles before they would come to a tiny diamond. Don't you think that's where the expression slim pickings originated?
Well, it seems like if they ran into a diamond that seldom that they might not even know what to look for and pass it over.
They probably had diamonds to show them so they could tell them what to look for. A lot of early diamonds apparently came from these river gravels of the Kitchener River, but there's not much in the way of diamond mining there today. Now, diamonds are found occasionally in lots of places. Diamonds, I checked once, and I think that a diamond has been found in every state in the Union. Somebody has just happened across one. But the original source of the diamond on Earth is thought to be in pipe mines, which I'll describe to you shortly. But going back to how come there can be diamonds here and there, it's explained in two ways. In geological processes, you know, we have the frost action and the river action and all this. So if diamonds were in an original location, such as a pipe mine in South Africa, which was once up on a high mountain, in the weathering process through the years, diamonds can be carried through streams which meander across the land, you know, for thousands of miles, and deposit diamonds. And the other explanation is the glaciers have moved across mountainous areas in which the original source of diamonds, called diamond pikes, in a mineral called kimberlite, and it could have taken it there. And the last explanation is the birds sing it, pick it up, and it goes through their system, and then it gets dropped somewhere. And in the United States, the last retreat of the glacier left what they call a glacier moraine across almost all of the mid-plain states. And that would extend, say, down maybe halfway through Illinois and follow a line of roughly maybe 45 or 50 degrees north latitude across the country. And along there, there seems to be a higher concentration of, a higher incidence of the finding of diamonds along where the glacier last came. Now, where the pipe mines were that those glaciers traveled across, nobody knows. But it may be in earlier history that there was land above ground at the North Pole. You see, nowadays all there is at the North Pole is ice and water. There is no land there. Well, the second source, the second important source after India for diamond, is the Brazilian source, which was discovered about the time of the American Revolution. It has a fascinating history. At that time, there was a gold rush on in Brazil. The main trading port of the world at that time for precious things like gold, diamonds, silver, was the port of Goa, which is located on the west coast of India. Now, the port of Goa was a port that was under Portuguese rule. Here you have India out there, and here are the Arab states and the various gulfs here in the Indian Ocean down there. It looks something like that. And Goa is over somewhere in here. Goa is an old place, 600 years of Portuguese rule. But during the time of the greatest Indian pacifist of all, whose name was Nehru, he staged a Hitler-like blitzkrieg attack on that port with planes and tanks, which I thought was, I don't know the old enough to remember, but I thought that's terrible. Here this guy had been preaching pacifism, you know, the world's greatest pacifist. Never harm an ant, you know, the Hindu religion. I have Hindu friends. They will not squash an ant. They will not eat an egg. Anything from which life springs, they will not take a life. They will not swat a fly. And if you invite them to your house for dinner, you hadn't better feed them anything like that. They have very strong scruples against that. And then they are always, you know, they really jumped on us for Vietnam War and other things like that. And yet Nehru, all of a sudden, without warning, assembles, just like Hitler did, a bunch of tanks and airplanes, and he takes that over. And it had been in Portuguese hands for 600 years. Well, that was the port where the business houses were for the trading and selling of precious gems and minerals and metals. There's a Portuguese man there whose name was Fonseca Lobo. He was familiar with all of this mining trade, but particularly gold, but he also knew about diamonds. Well, he got on a sailing vessel and he headed for Brazil for these gold fields to see what the situation was. When he arrived, he saw the miners playing cards at night, which I guess is a common practice for miners. But there was something uncommon about this practice in that they were not using Spanish doubloons or whatever the currency was of the day for counters in the card games. They were using diamonds, but the guys who were using them didn't know they were diamonds. So Fonseca Lobo struck up a bargain and bought all of these diamonds up and caught the very next sailing ship back to the port of Goa. A wealthy man. He let his friends know about his good fortune, and pretty soon there were hundreds of Europeans and others who were headed for the gold fields of Brazil. Now here's what had happened. When you pan for gold, you have a metal thing the shape of a pie tin, only it's larger. A miner's pan may be about that big. I bought one once. I was going to look for gold over here in the American Fork River, where they claim you can find it, but I never could get it in the bottom of my pan. So I had to satisfy myself with getting some down at Huckleberry Farm down in, what's Knott's Berry Farm down in Did I tell you about panning for gold down there? Didn't I? Well, you pay them a dollar and a half. And they have a regular sluice there with sand and little gravel pebbles in it, and Alaskan gold, which they put in there. Just so much gold in there. And then they charge you a dollar and a half to go in the pan for it. So I get the pan, and then the guy grabs your two wrists. He's going to show you how to do it. And I said, I know how to do it. But he wouldn't let loose. So I had to keep shaking him off. You know, let me do this. I want to do this. So I finally shook him off, and I got a good dollar and a half worth of gold out of it. But that's why they hang on to your wrist. I guess they don't want you to get it. They want you to get two bits worth of gold out so they can make a little money on the deal. But if you want the fun of panning for gold and ever go down there to Disneyland or Knott's Berry Farm, they probably still have that. It's kind of interesting to do it. Now, gold, you see, is very dense for its volume. It has a density of 19 grams per cubic centimeter. The ordinary sand and gravel that you encounter on the surface of the earth has a density of about 2.4. cubic centimeters. Diamond has a density of 3.5. Some of the iron minerals and some of the titanium minerals, which are fairly common, such as ilmenite, black iron oxide, have densities up around 7. When you pan for gold, you can tell that the gold is there because of its golden color, of course. But you usually have some black sands in the bottom with the gold. These are the various iron and titanium compounds, as a rule. But because they have a different color, you can, if it's big enough, you can just pick the gold out. Now, diamond, only having a density of 3.5, is not all that dense. And yet, you see, it's quite a bit more dense on a percentage basis than 2.4, the average silica. So it happened to be in the streams with the gold and everything else. And so as the miners would pan, sluice this thing around in the water and the sand the right way,
the diamond also ended up in the bottom of the pan. The guys just thought they were awfully interesting and pretty rocks. They didn't know they were diamond. But as soon as it was learned that this was diamond, then there was an awful lot of trouble, because diamond hunters descended on the gold hunters. And in any kind of a mining situation where there's the opportunity of getting rich real quick, you have an awful lot of trouble. And there was a lot of bloodshed and fighting over that. Well, diamonds still come from this area of Brazil. Now, the most important diamond find came in the period from about 1860 to 1880. And this occurred in South Africa. Did I ever tell you about South Africa and the, did I tell you about that part? And the four truckers down there, the Dutch Reformed Church? I'm going to tell you some history then you won't get in your regular history class, Grace. South Africa is a very interesting place. I'll draw you a map on it.
Looks like the one in India.
Might as well use the same map.
There's a great big bulge out here into the Atlantic Ocean. And it comes down here somewhere. Goes over in here up into the Arab States. It's something like that.
Now, this country, as you know, is a very rich country in minerals. The equator crosses it somewhere about in here. And during the great expansion years of the European nations, Great Britain, France, Germany, Portugal, Spain, and the rest of them, they were down in this country looking for riches in the way of mineral wealth and other things that could be taken from the country. You see, the whole colonial scheme, and I don't really think colonialism is so bad. They use that word in a very derogatory fashion nowadays. But the idea was to go out, particularly for England, to go out where the resources are and bring those resources to England where you manufacture them, upgrade the product. Manufacturing is taking raw materials and increasing the value of them. Of course, Japan is the great factor in this kind of an economy nowadays. They have no resources to speak of their own, but they get them from the rest of the world, and then they make things out of them and improve the product. Well, there was a lot of fighting. You know, it's just like the fighting over North America when it was discovered. The Dutch would claim this, and the French would claim it, and the English would claim it, and everybody would claim it. Well, now, at this same time, I'm going back to the time of Prophet Joseph, around 1830. That's when all this was going on. They were in here looking for ivory. They were looking for gold. They found spices, and they found hemp rope, and they found all kinds of things that are of interest. Well, now, a little before this time, there was religious persecution not only in America, but there was also religious persecution in the rest of the world. A lot of intolerance towards certain religious sects, particularly in European countries, which had assumed that one religion was going to be their state religion. People who do not belong to the state religion had lots of disadvantages, because they would take the taxes and support the state religion, for one thing. And of course, that hurts a church who's not in on that. And then there were other kinds of persecutions. There are still those kind of thoughts this day. I was with my wife in England once doing some genealogy work, and we were talking to the vicar in Countessville. And he had records that went clear back into the 1700s. Now, these vicars are supposed to have turned all these records over to the state, or, you know, to the government. Not supposed to have those private records anymore. They're supposed to send them into London. But they don't, because they make a killing on them. So this vicar, he'd cover everything up, and he'd go down the page, and he'd let you see one name. And so you had him a £5 note, and then he'd move on to another name. You just have to keep feeding him money to keep him moving along to see if some of your ancestors were in the genealogy there, because my ancestors happened to live in that area. Well, they were just that way, but later on, when we went down to London after some information, we arrived during the noon hour of the government employees, and they bent over backwards to help us, and their charge for looking things up was rather inexpensive. And I had to say, well, I sure do appreciate your taking your noon hour to do this for me. Wouldn't you take this £5 note for your labor? Oh, no, we can't do that. And I happened to say, well, boy, the vicars out there sure don't mind taking your £5 note for letting me look at their name. They said, oh, those vicars, they're a bunch of thieves. Well, the thing that bothered me the most about the vicar, though, was the way he talked about my ancestors. My mother's maiden name was Tracy, and my father's name was Howard, and so to avoid confusion, and I was named Howard Tracy, but they called me Tracy to avoid confusion with my dad. So I was looking for Tracy relatives, and he'd keep saying to me, Mr. Vicar, he'd say, well, I'd say, how about going over in that cemetery there and looking around? He had control, you know, of certain cemeteries, and certain cemeteries they consider holy ground and others they don't. And he says, no point going over there. Your ancestors aren't buried in holy ground. He was right, because they were, what did you call them in that day? I've forgotten them. They were nonconformists. They wouldn't conform to the Church of England religion like they're supposed to do in those days. Well, there was religious persecution, and people from Holland, in great numbers, left Holland and came down to Cape Town, which is the southernmost town down here. And they belonged to a church which today would be called the Dutch Reformed Church. I'm not sure what they called it in their day. The Dutch Reformed Church is located in America. I ran into it in the eastern part of the United States, but I've never seen it out west. Well, in 1836, they'd gone here, you see, to escape religious persecution from Holland. But they were getting it down here. They had lots of troubles. The British and the Dutch were fighting over this, and the Portuguese and others. So there was a war going on in the area, for one thing. And then they found that down here they couldn't even escape religious persecution, because the Church of England had come down there and they had its vicars and whatnot, trying to persecute these particular Protestants that belonged to this Dutch Reformed Church. So in 1836, just about 10 years, you see, before the Mormons decided to come west, they decided to get the heck out of there and come up in here. They headed for an area that was the junction of the Orange and the Vale Rivers, right there. Now, they had just the same kind of troubles, only worse, as some of our pioneer forefathers had. Now, this part of Africa tends to be wild animal country. They have their lions, and they have other kinds of meat-eating animals who would attack a man. It was not really inhabited at that time. You hear much in the newspapers these days, you know, it's whites who rule down here, and black people have control of all the rest of the continent nowadays, and they're trying to get control of this down here. But at that time in history, I've learned from my reading that really this was nobody's country. It was too wild. Now, at times, of course, the black man had been in this country, in a lot of prehistory, and he'd been out and out of that country. But at that time, he was not there. It was too wild. They were further north. But it just happened that at that time in history, fierce Arab tribes from up in this region had been penetrating down here in their drive for territory. And the black man, who consisted of cannibals in this time, was driven into this same country and arrived there just about the same as these Dutchmen arrived from this part. So these Dutchmen not only had wild animals to contend with, but many of them were killed and eaten by the cannibalistic tribes that
had been forced in that area by fierce Arab tribes from the north. Well now, this country here is high plateau country at 6,000 feet above sea level. Here in Provor, we are 4,300 feet above sea level. And it is more arid than our desert. It's desert country. It's hotter because it's closer to the equator than we are. They have the common thing that grows there is called the felt. The Dutchmen spell it that way and pronounce it felt, like F-E-L-T. If you're on a high hill in that country and you look out over the land in the spring, it looks very green. And it just looks like one huge field of beautiful velvet grass, and they call it felt. Now, if you get up close to it, what it is, it's a cluster of a real scrubby, tough brush. Not like sagebrush, but more of a grassy kind of a plant that grows in clumps like this and spaces out naturally a long ways from each other, just as sagebrush does naturally in our deserts, to conserve the water so that each plant can gather water from a large surrounding area where there's another plant. Now, interspaced among all these clumps of this tall, tough grass are huge anthills, hard as a rock and 3 feet tall. And the ants in that country could eat you alive. They cannot have any wooden telephone poles in that country. They cast them in concrete because these ants would chop through them in a couple of hours. Now, they homesteaded this area and fought the British again in this area. See, the British kept pursuing, and you've heard of the Boer War. The Boer War right there between the British government and these Dutch fur truckers. Fur trucker, what do you think that word means in English?
Is it trekked on ahead?
Pioneer. Yeah, it means pioneer. So these Dutch fur truckers had it out and the British won. Well now, there is a high flat-top hill near Pretoria, South Africa, which is about 50 miles from this river junction. And on top of that hill, there is a huge monument. And if you or I, as Latter-day Saints, were blindfolded, taken to that spot, and the blindfold were removed, and we looked at that monument, our first comment would be, "My word, who erected this tremendous monument to the Mormon pioneers?" Because that monument consists of a circle of giant-sized covered wagons carved in stone, women with the traditional Mormon pioneer bonnet, exactly, the yoked oxen and the guys with their old flintlock guns or whatever it was. Identical picture to what we would have in our minds of the Mormon pioneers coming across the United States plains. Well, it was the same thing, and for the same reasons. I don't know why we're so chintzy on the monuments we erect to the Mormon pioneers. Well, I do know why. We bent over backwards to please the anti-Mormons in this state when we ought to give them a good swift kick in the pants. But this monument is probably about 2 blocks in diameter and huge, giant size. It must have cost $1 million to create that monument. Until 1947, the monument that marked the coming of the Mormon pioneers was a little tiny granite marker. It's about like that. It was larger at the base, slanted up like that. And it says, here's where the Mormon pioneers first entered the Great Salt Lake Valley. But it's a big centennial celebration in 1847. They did erect the one that you see up in the mouth of Immigration Canyon now, which is more impressive. But still, it's not all that impressive. And we had to condescend to the people of the Catholic faith and put Father Escalante on there, you know, second to Brigham Young, and a few other things like we do to keep everybody happy. Well, these guys were farming. Awfully dry, awfully tough farming. Tougher than farming in Utah. But they believed in their religion, and they wanted to get away from persecution, and they were there trying to make a go of it and farm. Now, in the river gravels, near the junction of these rivers, were pretty rocks. They were silicates, such as a rock hound would collect. That is, they were mainly just SiO2, which gets hydrated with a certain amount of water, and
in its highest class, these kind of compounds are called opal. It's the only name I can think of. There are a whole lot of names of hydrated silicate rock hound minerals. There's one in Australia I'm trying to think of. Fire opal is this kind of a thing. It's just a hydrated silicate. These were yellow, blue, red, every color of the rainbow, and the kids would pick them up and carry them around in their pockets, just like a kid would do with pretty marbles today. So it's a common thing to see these on the dirt floors of the farmhouses, the log cabins is what they were, or out in the farmyard. Now one day, a little boy brought home a water white, really sparkly stone, different from any that had been seen before. He showed it to his mother. His mother's name was Frau Jacobs. Now a little later in the day, a neighbor by the name of Schaff van Nieker came to visit Frau Jacobs. And in their discussion, she mentioned this stone. Nieker said he'd like to see it. Well, a kid had thrown it out in the yard, but he didn't know where he'd thrown it, so he went out and retrieved it. And when Nieker saw that, he said he'd like to buy it. Well, Frau Jacobs just laughed at him and tossed him a stone and told him he could have it. Now, there were river boats plying the Orange River, some 200 miles here, down to the Atlantic Ocean. And he had it taken down there and then down to the Cape, where there was a British geologist who had a phenomenal name for a geologist, Arthur Stone. And Arthur Stone looked at this and said it was a diamond. Nieker eventually sold it for $5,000, and the story will be continued on Friday. Be sure you go to the Rex Gold Lecture tonight.